Good evening, everyone. Tonight we have Glenn Thrush, who is a reporter for Politico. He's just recently come to the White House after reporting on the Hill, and also he has a background we can get him to talk about as a newspaper man, and then has moved over to the online web world. So Glenn, can we start off by your talking about what your background is?
Well, I started off like, I guess this is not an, is it best to look over there?
No, you can look right there.
Look at the screen. Hello, everybody, first and foremost. I started off, I guess, in politics. I was obsessed with politics. I had mono when I was 5 years old. During the, and I was forced to stay home. It was one of the worst cases of mono that my doctor had ever seen. And I was forced to stay home for 5 or 6 months. And fortunately for me, that was the 5 or 6 months in which the Watergate hearings were taking place.
And you were five?
I was 5 years old. And my mother and I watched the Watergate hearings. So when most kids were sort of obsessed with Bugs Bunny, I was talking about Sam Irvin. and about I knew who Haldeman and Ehrlichman were, and I was weaned on this at a really early age, and I was just obsessed with politics.
What did you think it was about?
I knew what it was.
How did you see it?
Well, my mother spun it.
Uh huh.
In a fairly uncomplimentary way to the Nixon administration. So it gave me a real taste of this. And when I was 8 or 9 years old, my elementary school gave you the option of spending a nickel each day to get a copy of the New York Times. And man, it was a life-changing event. I love the way the paper smelled. I love the way the paper felt. I read the thing from cover to cover, and I didn't understand a damn thing. But I just loved the feel of the newspaper. And around that time, my school suddenly had this series of electives, preschool electives, at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I think this was when I was in fourth grade. And I was a terrible student. And my parents couldn't drag me out of bed to go to school. I was just a really indifferent student. And every morning that this thing was, I got up and I went, and I was the only student in this class.
What was the class?
It was a journalism newspaper. Uh-huh. I had to put together a newspaper, and uh-huh. I don't remember much about it, but I remember it was the most fascinating thing that I had ever mm-hmm. been involved with. And so I was just at a very early age in love with both newspapers and politics. I thought I wanted to be a senator, and I started off. My parents owned. I hope this isn't getting too detailed, but my parents owned an ice cream store in Brooklyn, in a neighborhood in Brooklyn called Brighton Beach, which is down by the Atlantic Ocean. And a congressman named Steve Solars was had a district office upstairs.
He was from graduate school class.
Oh, really?
That I was in, yeah.
At Columbia?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Steve and I went up there and I started volunteering, and I started writing stuff, most starting off with constituent letters and then congressional record pieces. And one day the congressman himself sort of came up to my, and I was a furry-looking kid wearing like a baseball jersey. And he came up and he said, you're a really good writer, and we want to pay you to write press releases and correspondence for the office. So at age 19 or whatever, I was managing going to school at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, because I got booted from Brandeis University.
Which year?
My freshman year, first semester, I got kicked out of Brandeis because I wasn't going to class. For those of you watching out there, please don't follow my example. But I was going to Brooklyn College in the days, managing my parents' ice cream store at night, and in whatever time I had working for the congressman and writing stuff. Long story short, I came to Washington, I did an internship, and they weren't letting me do anything but write. And it was they weren't letting me sort of deal with any of the campaign stuff. They just wanted me, because up on Capitol Hill, there are not a lot of folks who are really good at producing written material. This was the pre-internet age.
And on deadline, too.
So at some point, I realized that I enjoyed the writing more than the working for the politician. And I started working for local newspapers, giveaway weeklies in New York City. And I had the tremendous good fortune The first one I worked for, the Downtown Express in Lower Manhattan in Tribeca, was run by Clay Felker, who was the founder of New York Magazine.
Yeah.
And the editor under him was a guy named Jan Hodenfield, who was a former writer for Rolling Stone, who wrote the cover story on Woodstock. And so my first experience with editors was my best experience with it. It's been all downhill from there. And it really, and these guys taught me how to really write a magazine story. And write a magazine story in the mid-1970s fashion, which is a really sort of grab them by the lapels kind of way. And since then, I've really sort of like, it's funny, I tell people that I have devolved. Because from there I went and I worked for 2 years as a state house and education reporter for the Birmingham Post-Herald in Alabama, where I covered the Black Belt, the poorest area of Alabama, and education reform. And then I came back.
How did you end up there?
I was editor and publisher, which I don't know, I don't think there's a print edition of it any longer. But editor and publisher used to have ads in the back. And there were several that were recurring, the Anchorage Daily News, a paper in Wyoming, and the Alabama paper. They would just cycle through reporters because they, you know, they were crappy places to work. And I thought about going to Anchorage, but a friend of mine had just done one of those stints on a fishing boat and didn't like it very much and said that there were like 10 men for every woman. And Wyoming didn't really appeal to me. I'd been there once, didn't like it. But I was fascinated by civil rights history, and I had just finished reading Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters, which is, if any of you, by a Baltimore author, Taylor Branch, who you can who's listed in the phone book. You can call him up and talk to him. He doesn't like it, but you can. Just sort of talking about the heroism in Alabama and Mississippi. And so I was on fire with that stuff, and I went down there and got a real opportunity to cover parts of the country that hadn't really changed that much, and really still one of the most gratifying things that I did. Came back to New York. I'm from Brooklyn. I am born and bred, and freelanced for a bunch of places, New York Magazine, the New York Times Magazine, Spin. I was for a short period of time, I was senior editor of Guitar World Magazine, using the nom de plume Glenn Thrash. And after that, I hooked up with an outfit called City Limits, which was a magazine that covered low-income housing in New York City. And we had a think tank that covered child welfare. And from there, I wasn't making a lot of money, so my wife encouraged me to look elsewhere, and I started working for I had some stints at the New York Daily News, the New York Observer. And when I was at the New York Observer, I was recruited by Bloomberg News, which was then starting up a non-financial New York City news bureau. And Bloomberg pays really well. And my wife was enthusiastic about that. I did that for 2 years until Mike Bloomberg left the company and ran for mayor. And I was covering some politics, and I didn't want to cover politics at a news organization that was founded by the mayor of New York. So I went to work for Newsday in their City Hall Bureau, which was a great experience. Worked there for 3 years until I was told that they wanted to send me down to Washington to cover Hillary Clinton, her reelect in the Senate, and her subsequent presidential run. And I did that until September of 2008, when I was recruited by Politico, and have been working here ever since.
What? Tell us about the differences of working for a newspaper, and you certainly work for a lot of different newspapers, print publications. Is there something that's common among all of the print organizations that you've worked for, and how does that compare with what you're doing now?
I think there's a great deal of commonality. I mean, what I've learned across, you know, and I joke that I've worked for sort of every increment of time in journalism, from sort of blogs to wire service to daily stories to weekly to monthly. And what I've learned is sort of telling a story and adapting your storytelling style to the venue is a really important, is the most important, I think, skill. What I mean by that, it's a fancy way of saying, you have to understand who you're writing for, what the audience is, who your bosses are, while maintaining your own style and how it is that you choose to tell a story. Mm-hmm. So if you're writing for obviously a wire service functions a great, has a function that's totally different than when you're writing a New York Times Magazine uh-huh. story. So, you know, one of them is more gratifying than the next. But what I think differentiates people who are good from people who aren't is trying to master that form and to really try to serve the people that are reading you, to give them, to make it easy on them, to tell them what the story means. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel just very strongly about that. I think that every single story that you write, no matter how insignificant the topic or how significant the topic, should be written in a way that really allows people to understand what's going on.
How do you know who you're writing for?
I think that's a great question. Great question. A lot of times you don't. And it takes a long time to figure out uh-huh. what that audience is. A lot of times you make mistakes and assume you're writing for one group of readers when you're not. Politico is actually the easiest place I've worked for to figure that out because the editors have such a strong sensibility about who we're writing for. We're writing for sort of professionals and junkies, political mm-hmm. junkies. So we can use a lot of sort of shorthand and ways of dealing with the audience that you couldn't use at a place like Newsday. I found Newsday to be very frustrating. Newsday serves, for those of you who don't know, Newsday serves Long Island and some parts of the city. But when I was there, we had a circulation scandal, and our circulation shrunk from like 580,000 to 400,000, and our city circulation wasted away. And I was living in the city. I was actually raised, part of my childhood was spent on Long Island, but I was really writing for city readers. Uh-huh. And, you know, so I think a lot of times my copy at Newsday was not perfectly suited to sort of the suburban readers that,
uh-huh.
yeah, that read us. So I think it's a great question. I mean, it's important to, that's an instance in which I wanted to write for who I wanted to write for and didn't give a damn. And uh-huh. as long as my editors let me do what I wanted to do. But when I was in a bunch of my jobs, you just really have to understand the readership.
Uh-huh. I know one guy who used to be down in the basement at the White House where we are, Don Folsom, who was a UPI, used to talk about the Buffalo Milkman. And there are a lot of people who will say they're writing, they have their mother in mind
right.
as an image.
Well, that's funny. The way that I've often said that, like, I write for a very intelligent 14-year-old kid because you want to have somebody who has an orientation. You want to have somebody who has an orientation towards the kind of work that you're doing, so you don't have to dumb it down too much. But it's just somebody who is naive to the subject matter. So you can write it in a way that's sharp and knowing, but you also need to provide the context. I mean, that's uh-huh. another thing. That's another trick that a lot of reporters, I don't think, have figured out, and that is to write something that moves fast and has that kind of velocity uh-huh. and is sort of knowing and has a slightly cynical edge, but it actually lets you in on the joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's a real analogy to be made between sort of stand-up comedy and popular humor and journalism, because you can be cool and tell a joke, but you want to have as large as possible an audience in on that joke. And I think it's the same thing with journalism. You want to sort of do something that's cool and snappy and works, mm-hmm. you know, works as prose, but that also lets the maximum number of people in on the joke.
Uh-huh. Are there certain elements that are common to a story, no matter where it is, whether it's something you wrote in Alabama or something that you did for Newsday or at Politico? Like, for example, the importance of accuracy, for example.
Yeah.
And you can see other kinds of things that are in common.
Well, I think accuracy, I'm not ashamed to admit this, when I first started out in the business, I was not a particularly accurate reporter. My heroes were not wire service reporters. You know, my heroes were sort of prose stylists and people uh-huh. who sort of like, and quote-unquote new journalists, you know, I mean, Truman Capote did not have a fact checker. If he did, none of his books would have gotten published. So I really had to learn the hard way in this business. And I made some mistakes when I was young. And fortunately, I had editors who understood that it wasn't because I had a disdain for accuracy, but because I was thinking about something else. But you can't succeed at all in this business unless you are extraordinarily careful about that sort of thing. And in blogs particularly, because I think blogs have this reputation to start with of being fast and loose.
Mm-hmm.
So the good thing about running a blog and working online is that you can correct quickly. So
how do you find out you need to correct?
Well, sometimes you find out from an editor. Hopefully you find out from an editor before something is published. But when I've been running a blog for about a year and a half, and sometimes you find out from readers.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, and this is part of the economics of the news business. More and more responsibility for fact-checking your work is vested in the reporter. And frankly, the reporters that succeed in this business are those who can self-edit, both in terms of writing and in terms of making sure that they're getting things right. I mean, that's not a happy reality, but it's the reality.
No, it doesn't seem to be. Because it seems that you all are asked to perform the functions of several different people in the past. You'd have a copy editor, an editor, and today it seems like stories come out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And without a lot of eyes seeing it.
No, I think in my organization there's like, I should say that when things go up on the, there's a difference between stories and blog posts, and when things go up on the, in blog posts, it's quick and dirty.
Yeah, tell us what you do, say from the beginning of the day, how you start, what you read, and then what you produce.
Well, I have a, I'm not being rude, guys, I am, I've just turned in a story, and my editors are, my editors are emailing me, so this is not me being rude. This is how I finish my day. I start off in the morning. For a long time, I was not getting the print edition of the New York Times, just the Washington Post, but I've recently gotten the Times print edition, which I think really, I read the A section from cover to cover, even if I don't read every story. I mean, that's mm-hmm. kind of a discipline that I'm that I've sort of adopted.
Uh-huh.
Just because you feel like you have more of a rounded sense of what's going on. And at the in Congress, you could read. I should say I was transferred to the White House about a month ago, and so things have changed. When I was up on the Hill, I would much more narrowcast, and I would use what are known as RSS feeds, which are Google alerts on particular names. And so the first thing I would do is I would sort of go through my inbox and see what Barney Frank or Michelle Bachmann or Nancy Pelosi had said overnight, just to sort of understand, just to read, to come uh-huh. up to speed on that sort of thing. A lot of reporters today do that. And then also I have a very specialized Twitter account where I'm tracking sort of the news aggregators and people like Chuck Todd in the White House, and I go through about 200 or 300 Twitter messages to sort of see what's popped.
How can you go through 200 to 300 of those?
It's one of the, you know, you have to have ADD. I'll be honest with you. As this business has kind of progressed, I've noticed that the people in the newsroom are increasingly, there are fewer normal people in the newsroom. You get people who have OCD and people with ADD. You've got anal retentive types and then sort of information omnivores, and I'm one of the latter. I mean, I can really scan a lot of information and pluck out things.
Uh-huh.
And it's been my nature ever since I'm a kid. I've been this way. It's why I couldn't sit still in a chair in school, uh-huh. and why I didn't succeed in school, particularly uh-huh. because I needed the stimulation.
Uh-huh.
And I find a lot of people. It's really funny. You'll sit around with colleagues, and they'll be like, "They tried to put me on Ritalin when I was in second grade, and now I'm making a living doing this stuff." Part of the White House is a different, as you know, uh-huh. is a totally different animal, and you sort of need to have a more well-rounded news intelligence. And I find, like, reading the A section of the Times, and to a lesser extent, unfortunately, the Post, in print really facilitates that. It makes you feel like you're walking into the day prepared. Mm-hmm. But then I'll go on, I will review my own website, and then I'll go through those feeds and stuff. When I was blogging, and I'm doing less of that now, I'm transitioning out of blogging, I'd be up at 5:30 in the morning.
Why are you doing less blogging?
Well, because it's a congressional blog, and part of my demand for making this transition, because I have a young family, is to do less blogging, which just eats your life. Uh-huh. Eats your life. You're talking, I'm talking 14, 16-hour a day job with blogging. Mm-hmm. So coming to the White House has actually made, is giving me more of a conventional, uh-huh. conventional news life uh-huh. than blogging, which blogging is exhilarating. It's a lot of fun. Everyone is your source. You just get a ton of tips, but it's just, it's all consuming.
How do you tell a good tip from a bad tip?
Your report. Well, first of all,
because you're going to, you know, your inbox is going to have a huge number of things.
Right. Well, the basic, you know, most of the tips we get are not from my friend Ben Smith, who runs probably the most trafficked blog on the site, the more general political blog. Mine is a congressional blog. Gets like crowdsourcing tips all the time from people like. He'll get a reader in California who works for a union and will leak him a memo.
Uh-huh.
I tend to get fewer of those. I tend to get, my stuff tends to come from people on the Hill.
Uh-huh.
So I will tend to know who they are, or at least know who they work for.
Uh-huh.
So,
Now, that's very useful for you coming to the White House,
yeah.
because the White House often does not release information, and you need to go to the Hill for it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tend to be an outside-in reporter anyway, and by outside-in I mean because I, you know, there are reporters on the Hill. The blog was pretty successful, and I broke a good deal of news, and I had not had any real experience covering the Hill. I'd covered Hillary and Chuck Schumer, but that's not the same as covering the Hill, and so I always adopted sort of an outside-in approach where you got people who are former staffers and consultants mm-hmm. and people who were outside the institution who were obtaining information from inside the institution. And that allowed me to develop sources because people, the main thing with being a reporter is your sources have to respect you.
Mm-hmm.
They have to know that you can execute on a story and that you get it right and that your stories have impact. So my sense is when you're heading into a new institution, and I'm a newness junkie. I love new beats. I just love a new beat. It's like a new toy. And I find the best way for you to source inside the institution, like in Congress or the White House, is to present them with credible information from outside
mm-hmm.
and force them to confront it. I think there are a lot of reporters who sit around in all beats and sort of wait for the story to come to them.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of they are told, this press person, this press office, this press secretary, this communications director, even this chief of staff, are going to give you the information you need, and they just sit and wait for it.
Do you think many people do it that way?
I think some people do. I think fewer now. When I was first starting out, a lot of people were much more complacent about it.
Uh-huh.
Or I think actually the more pernicious thing is to think you're getting good stuff when you're not getting good stuff.
There was a reporter who covered the White House who said that at the White House, you're not given information. He said, like a miner, you have to dig for it. You have to go to the bureaucracy and to the Hill. And it was William Price, and he was writing in 1902.
So this has been totally the same.
Yeah, there's a lot. There is a lot.
I have not invented this entire.
pray not. Yeah. So, yeah.
Because I find that,
He said, like a miner, you have to dig.
Yeah, or you have to, you know, or the other thing is like, or if the analogy that I have is fishing with a hand grenade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you have to be a little less than subtle. Because these guys, the only experience I've had that's really analogous to this is where it's a closed system. Because the White House is, the other way that I've described it, I described it to somebody today is like, trying to cover the captain of a submarine from a locked torpedo room
mm-hmm.
because you just can't, you are physically proximal to what's going on,
uh-huh.
but you just have no way.
So how do you cover it? Like, say, on a normal week, how are you going to get information? Where would you start?
Well, I do keep in touch with the people in the press office. Uh-huh. I read everything that everyone writes. Oftentimes, you can find the best stories in the 10th paragraph of a New York Times story. Because people, you know, stories are determined at budget meetings at newspapers, and a lot of times editors are great, but they're overworked or they're distracted, and they don't realize that the best stuff is buried in the bottom of a story. And you can find a lead or sort of a theme that's just lurking there that no one else is really... I'll give you a little bit of an example. This is not from the necessarily from a newspaper, but from the Sunday shows. I was watching the Sunday shows a couple of weeks ago, and I just noticed that a lot of the Democrats were dancing around a particular theme, and that was the Roberts Court. Obviously, we have, you know, with the retirement of John Paul Stevens, we have a new Supreme Court nomination battle shaping up. We don't have a nominee, a candidate yet. But on the Sunday shows, the Democrats were sort of, not in a very disciplined way, but sort of playing around with the idea that the Roberts Court has gotten very conservative, and sort of testing this theme of sort of attacking the Roberts Court rather than defending whoever the nominee was. And that struck me as being interesting because I think the first rule of political campaigns that I understand is that you attack when you can attack. And you try not to be put on the defensive. And so it just struck me from sort of watching the Sunday shows, and again, this was not something that anyone had told me, that this might be a really fruitful way for the Democrats to handle the process, which is to not turn it into a referendum on Obama, not to turn it into a referendum even on Obama's nominee, but to turn it into, but to flip the Republican argument against activist liberal jurists into a potential Democratic talking point against activist conservative jurists. And, you know, I don't think I am the first one to say this. The Roberts Court, you know, with the Citizens United decision and the Lilly Ledbetter decision have, according to judicial scholars across the ideological spectrum, been a fairly activist court on the conservative side. And sure enough, I started making a lot of calls on this, and this was emerging as a strategy. And this, I think, is going to be one of the core strategies. And I got Patrick Leahy, the Judiciary Committee chairman, on the horn. And he confirmed that. And he said, yeah, this is how we're going to go about this, that we're going to turn this into a referendum on the Roberts Court. And, you know, that's what my bosses like to call a thought scoop, which is, it's kind of a cool, it's kind of a cool thing that they value, which is to sort of, come up with an analytical frame that hasn't yet been out there. And sure enough, it became kind of like, it became something people were talking about. Other reporters sort of did stories based on that theme, and it got mentioned in a couple of hearings. So that's kind of like, I think, you know, that's a good way that you can sort of, you just sort of see what's in the, you know, see what's in the air and sort of pull it together into something.
What relationships did you have coming into the White House that have been useful for you? Because Obama came from the Senate, so there must be people that you knew up on the Hill.
Well, it's weird. I'm old, right? Being old helps because you're just surprised by how, you know, of the people that you run into. Like people that
Helen is old.
Yeah. I'm 40, so it's like, I can't believe I'm 40. It's extremely depressing. But you just, it's really weird. You just wind up bumping into people that you didn't remember you knew. People who are working in committee, you know, and when you get your name out there, you get interesting phone calls and emails from folks. And you also have to use your, you have to exploit your relationships. You have to, like, if somebody lives on your block whose husband works for the Ways and Means Committee, you've got to, like, have a barbecue and chat with them about it. So, I mean, to a certain way, it infects and pollutes your entire life because you're always sort of on the lookout for stuff. But my beachhead has always been New York. I'm a New York reporter. I'm sourced in New York. I understand the city really well. It's my, you know, it's recreationally what I'm interested in. And so, for me, when I came up on the Hill, you know, that was the beachhead. It was the New York delegation and the New York folks. And to a certain extent, it still is. You know, I knew David Axelrod, the senior advisor to the president, in the context of Freddie Ferrer's failed Democratic mayoral bid in 2001. So it's like, you know, the cool thing about being from New York is stuff passes through. So you have, like, and John Del Sicato and Anita Dunn and all these folks who are involved in, you know. So you've got to work what it is that you, you know, the point is to get out there and to sort of interact with people and develop as many contacts and present sort of a positive image of yourself, or at least an image of yourself as somebody that people can talk to and trust.
How do, well, I can see with Politico how you get read.
Yeah.
But when you were at the Daily News, how would you, well, there I guess you'd be read too by the New York delegation. Yeah. So you really haven't had a problem getting read.
Oh, I did. Well, when I ran City Limits, City Limits, we had a circulation, I think, at our low point of 1,800. Mm-hmm. And try to get the mayor's press office to call you back when you have a circulation of 1,800. The key is you got to break news, and if you can't, and there's a multiplier effect too. I used to teach journalism for a number of years at Columbia and NYU, and what I used to tell young reporters is, you're a guitar, but you need an amplifier. You're an electric guitar, but you need an amplifier. You have to think of it as a two-step process. You have to be able to play the music, and you have to be able to master your instrument, which is journalism, but you also have to figure out a way to plug into a pretty powerful amplifier. Nowadays, it's a lot easier because you can Twitter stories out, you can email people about it, you can get stuff up on a blog, but back in those days, what I had to do was to sort of call up other reporters and get them to follow the story, or if I broke, like for instance, when I was at City Limits, we did some very good work, I mean, you know, about sort of children's mental health, and about scandals involving housing, you would call up city council members and state assembly members and state senators. You would call them and you would say, you know, this is something which your committee has purview over. Could you at least just take a look at this story? And you'd get people to hold hearings. It was the first investigative story I ever did. Is this too boring?
No.
Was about a in Lower Manhattan, a place called the Bond Hotel, which was a single-room occupancy hotel on the corner of Chambers and Broadway, West Broadway. And it was 150 years old, and what made it famous was Lincoln slept there the night he gave his famous Cooper Union House Divided speech. I think it was his House Divided speech. It had turned into a single-room occupancy hotel. And I remember reading, they have these things called community boards, just these local boards in New York, and I remember reading just on a flyer that the occupancy, they had to apply for, the owners had to apply for what was called a certificate of no harassment. What the hell is a certificate of no harassment? Well, single room occupancy hotels don't pay the owners very much, and most of the tenants are elderly or disabled, and they have an agreement, and the owners of the hotels are bound by law to have these folks in these hotels as residents paying a pittance. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that all the people who own the SROs do whatever they can to either buy out or harass these tenants, occupants to get out. So I just went down there and I did my due diligence, and I discovered that the owners were running German Shepherds through the halls. There were 12 or 14 people, 85-year-old folks. They were flooding. I went there with a camera, and there was like an 85-year-old former merchant seaman from Mobile, Alabama, who was sitting cross-legged on his cot because there were 2 feet of water in his room. He'd been flooded. And I wrote the story, and nobody picked it up, and I just started aggressively shopping it around to local elected officials. And a city council candidate picked it up, and then it got picked up by one of the dailies, and then it became an editorial, and then the city cracked down on these landlords, and these people got new housing. So it's a long answer to a short question, but you've got to be, and it's the same thing now, you've got to be willing to sort of hook up what you do to a place that can, to people who can do something about it.
Now, I can see the satisfaction in doing that kind of story. Yeah. What kind of satisfaction is there in a White House story?
Much less. And that, you know, It is a much, it, to a very degree, it's funny, the higher you sort of get on the journalistic food chain, the less fun you have. That's kind of a joke about it. You don't get to answer police radios or do any, you know, or like save the world. The satisfaction is sort of, is having influence. This is a town, Washington. You know, I come from a town, New York, where the predicate is money, right? Where mm-hmm. the fundamental commodity is money, right? Real estate is really about money. Entertainment industry, it's all about cash. Here, it's all about power. Mm-hmm. It's all about getting power, using power, wielding influence. I think the satisfaction of writing a good White House story is to capture something that makes people change the way that they think about something, or to introduce a new fact that sort of changes the game. What you want to have is impact. Mm-hmm. And I think the sort of existential question you have to ask yourself as a reporter is, what is the nature of that impact? Is it a good impact or is it a bad impact?
And how is the impact? Describe what kind of impact. Like impact within the White House, within the Washington community, and within the newspaper or within the journalism world.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things you were asking about audiences, engaging audiences. I haven't yet figured that out with the White House. Uh-huh. It's a beat unlike any other beat that I've covered, because mm-hmm. even a small piece of information could be leveraged into a big impact. The amazing thing about the White House is the minor scraps of information that would just come your way in the course of regular reporting at other places are closely held secrets in the White House, because mm-hmm. every piece of information is considered to be so valuable and is such a journalistic commodity. And, you know, reporters get raises and promotions based on scoops. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finding out that the president is taking a trip to New York on Thursday isn't very important in the larger scheme of things. But if you're a reporter who's on a dry streak and you break a piece of information, you know, break a little news story like that, it's not bad. I've always had a slightly different view of what it was that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so sort of reconciling that kind of mini scoop, which really doesn't have any impact on the world whatsoever, and a larger impact is something I'm working out. What is driving me though is, and I think what really drives all reporters is a curiosity about institutions. And there's nothing more mysterious or interesting, I think, than sort of a place like the White House. And that's really what's sort of motivating me now. It's a weird place. It's a powerful place. I'm also somebody who's really motivated by the cast of characters. Mm-hmm. Who's in that building? Who is in that room? I'm just fascinated. I'm just sort of fascinated by how the various personalities work. So,
yeah, which is sometimes hard to find out.
Yeah.
Even though they're releasing lists each month of who's coming in. But it's still somewhat difficult to know who's in the room when a important decision
or what they said, because people, you know, the mantra that I always get, I am always the problem that I face as a reporter is I write what are called process pieces. I write the mm-hmm. stories that I do best, the ones that get the most impact, are stories that sort of tell you how something went down, and those stories have huge impact, and they are. You know, Game Change, the book, the Halpern Heilman book, which has been just a sensation, is a process book. Mm-hmm. It's easier to write, it's a history, so that makes it easier. It's very tough when you're in the situation to write process pieces, because nobody wants to give you access to the sort of stuff that they give historians access to, because it will influence, mm-hmm. because, you know, it will have an influence on the game ahead. So I find that White Houses, campaigns are very resistant to process pieces and very smart about how to manage them. They get you inside the meeting. Think about this. I mean, particularly, and we haven't talked about sourcing, but when they're using unnamed sourcing, they'll get you inside.
Because that book is all
unnamed sourcing. They'll get you inside the meeting, but the question is, the person who is telling you about that meeting and sort of enticing you to write about it, has complete control of the information that you have about that meeting, unless you're able to source it independently. So, I had that issue today about where I had three or four anonymous sources sort of characterizing a meeting that took place on the hill, and as I, it's a Rashomon kind of thing. You know, as you talk to a different person, you get a different perspective on that. And that's where I think experience comes in, because it's the sum of those. You apply your judgment to it, and it's the sum of that sourcing that gives you, I think, a picture of what actually happened.
Uh-huh. Can you, let's say in the 19th century, starting in the 19th century, before there was a person who was assigned the duty of dealing with the press exclusively, the person who was analogous to the chief of staff, who was the private secretary,
like would John talk, Hay or?
Yes, but a little later. It would be kind of in the 1880s and 90s. You could go to, particularly, there was a guy who worked for Grover Cleveland. Cleveland didn't like meeting with the press. So if you had a story, you would go to him and say, Would I be wrong if I say tomorrow in my newspaper article that blah 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 blah, that they won't give you a story, but they would not let you print something that was false.
Right.
And I mean, that started in the latter part of the 19th century, and you can see it through parts of the 20th.
Right.
Do you find that still happens today?
The would I be wrong stuff?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Because the thing that I find really frustrating at the White House is, you know, the way this is supposed to work is you get a piece of information, you call them up, and you say, on the record, is this right or is it wrong, and do you have a comment? The White Houses don't deal with information that way.
Mm-hmm.
Off the record, that's complete horseshit. Pardon my language.
Mm-hmm.
Off the record, that's completely inaccurate. Well, what good does that do me? For those of you that are uninitiated, this is a very rough way to put it. Off the record means I can't quote the person and I can't use the information that they're giving me in the story. But I can use that, but I can call up someone else and say, author, I'm hearing this. That's my understanding of off the record. Now, the White House, now I didn't know
they might have a different view.
Right. In the White House, and I'm pretty religious about that. I mean, a lot of reporters have a very permeable membrane with off the record. Now, the White House has like these gradations of background. Background is the next level. And on background, the way that I do it is I negotiate with the source on how I'm going to identify them. And I want to identify them in the most specific way possible, an mm-hmm. aid to a certain person on it, you know. And if the person doesn't agree on a specific enough attribution, I won't use the quote. Because everyone wants to be a Democrat or a Republican, an unnamed. No, you can't do that.
Uh-huh.
If you've got a dog in the fight, I have to at least be able to associate you with a camp.
Uh-huh.
And then there's on the record. But White Houses don't. You know, the first thing they'll do, they don't even want to get because a comment is news, and mm-hmm. so they won't even give you the benefit of giving you a comment. So you have to spend a fair amount of your time trying to bring people above ground. Even a comment on something someone else said.
And how do you do that?
By yelling, screaming, uh-huh. by trying to shame people into stuff.
Were you surprised when it came out during the whole Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame issue, Carl Rove, that Louis Libby negotiated with Judith Miller of the New York Times that he wanted to be referred to, although I think she ended up not using it, but he wanted to be referred to as a former Hill worker.
Yeah, that's to me unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, that, I just had never heard of anything like that.
Well, one of my colleagues reported about a year ago that, and this is sort of amazing, is that there was a State Department employee who wanted to be referred to as a White House source, like a White House official.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was Glenn Kessler, maybe. One reporter was like, well, how can I do that? And the guy said, because I'm standing right now in the White House. Which is just amazing.
Yeah.
You got to be really careful about that sort. You got to be really careful about that sort of thing. Again, the specificity is really important. Now, the other thing that's really important is, and I hate to say this, and no one wants to admit this, but the importance of the story we had an issue yesterday with where Robert Gibbs called out the New York Times, fairly extraordinary way, for David Sanger's story on Sunday, citing excerpts from a memo pertaining to the Iran's nuclear threat. There's a lot of back and forth as to why Robert Gibbs, the White House press secretary, chose to do that. Some people opine that it was because he was covering his tracks, you know. But his point was that you can't quote specific portions of the memo without having possession of the entire memo. And quoting an administration official who read you the selected parts of the memo. And my thought initially was Gibbs was making a mistake, but in retrospect, I think sort of he had a point.
Well, I won't name the person, but I went to a luncheon where there was a reporter who had written a book that had, this is during the Bush administration, and it had a lot of documents that were top secret. And so I asked him how he could get top secret documents from an administration that was trying to shut down information. And so when pressed, because we went back and forth some on it, what was pretty clear to me is that's what happened, is that he was read, the person read him the documents. But I wondered whether you could watch the person read, in that you're looking at the document. You don't touch the document physically, and that's how you're sure. Because in his case, he said he was positive that he had what he had put.
Well, I think
in this work.
Well, to me, then, you know, the story isn't that you are. I mean, I think it's a very slippery slope, that sort of thing. And I think, again and again, this is a situational ethics that probably most people wouldn't be comfortable. But I will candidly tell you that, like, the import of that document is, I think, the deciding factor in your judgment. If it's if the document is a letter that pertains to a political decision in a campaign, or something relatively minor or an anecdotal thing, then I don't have a problem with that. If it's a document that has sort of an impact on national security, or purports to describe a process within the White House on something really significant, I think you've got to think twice on that. You might be able to leverage that information into something else. You might be able to say that a senior administration official, I think it would have been more legitimate, for instance, it would have given to have said, like, a senior administration official says that there is an ongoing debate within the White House about this topic, but I think sort of quoting the memo decontextualized may not have been a great decision. And again, the Times is a great paper, and Sanger is an awesome reporter. So I and that's another factor here, the fact that Sanger is so well sourced on this stuff. This is why there are no hard and bright lines here. Gave his editors and I think his readers a higher level of confidence that his characterization of that story was accurate. So it's a very tough question to adjudicate.
Well, let's take some questions from students. Got some questions there?
Yes. I was just wondering, when you write a story, do you get a lot of blowback from the political parties if your story puts them in a bad light?
Yeah. I get blowback. I get blowback from, you know, sometimes I get preemptive blowback, like I'm getting tonight on my BlackBerry as I'm sitting here. You get blowback all the time. And sometimes you get blowback even when the story wasn't particularly bad. People just like to put down markers and let you know that they can't be pushed around. That's part of the process. The other thing is, you know, the people that you deal with on these stories over time tend to be people you develop relationships with. So I'm a confrontational kind of reporter. A lot of people aren't. I enjoy the back and forth. I enjoy challenging my sources. And often I find that some of the best sources I developed in my career were people who called me up to scream at me about a story, and I'm able to sort of argue with them. I think people are really either freaked out or terribly impressed when you're willing to engage them on their criticism. And I really love that part of the job. Somebody sends me, I get a lot of whack job emails from people who are just nuts and say, you're a left-wing hack, you're a right-wing hack, you're just a hack.
How many emails would you get a day on a story?
Well, you get comments. You know, sometimes, you know, you'll get as little on a story, you'll get as little as 20 and as many as 4,000 comments. Uh-huh. And some of them will break out into emails. But a lot of people choose not to send emails. But they'll basically write you a letter in the form of the comments, and you just get this terrible, you know, sometimes extremely personal. Like, they'll read your biography on the site and be like, you're they'll make fun of you. You're an idiot. You're from Brooklyn, so everyone knows you're an idiot, you know. Or take off the stupid hat is what I get a lot. So when someone really hits you with something that's thoughtful, either a source, a participant in the story, or somebody from out of the blue, you know, it's pretty exciting, and you engage them. Like, if somebody is just whacking you for, like, you said you wrote a lousy story about my boss, that's not interesting. But if someone really comes back at you with a point that's a valid point, and you really engage them, you know, that's a friendship you're starting to develop. When you show that you're willing to engage somebody and that you respect their opinion and that you're willing to change or pivot future stories based on what they told you, you know, that's a developing a relationship, and relationships are what we're all about.
Uh-huh. Do you find that people from the White House respond to your stories? How often would that happen, like, say, in a month? How many times would you hear from the White House, and what are they apt to respond to, stories they don't like or stories they do like?
Oh, they never respond to stories they like. Oh, you never get a response to stories they like. And if you really nail them between the eyes, if you nail someone between the eyes, they'll never respond. They'll stonewall you. It's the ones in between that you get. The funniest reaction I got so far, and it's been a very short run, and they do tend to respond, you know, to stuff. Sometimes, before I came here, I wrote a White House story that got like 10 people screaming at me and emails to my editors and stuff. When they're really dissatisfied, they will go up the food chain and rain on you from above.
Now, will they do that on the Hill?
Oh, yeah.
They'll go to your editors?
Oh, yeah. They'll go to your editors, they'll go to your boss, they'll sometimes go to your publisher. Uh-huh. They would do that, they do that everywhere, but because the folks who founded Politico, Jim Vandehye and John Harris, were both exceptional reporters and editors who are very well known on the Hill, people have pre-existing relationships with them, so they feel really comfortable calling them up. To just be like, this, you got to fire this jackass. He's just getting things wrong.
Uh-huh.
You know, or you got to take this down right away.
What response will they have?
They're great. It's one of the reasons I really like working here. You know, very seldom have I made, you know, if it's an error or something, we correct it immediately and I lead the charge on that. But if it's like a story they don't agree with, my bosses have always deferred to me, and I mean, I'm not just sort of saying it. They're just really, it's very cool having guys who did this, because they really understand. They really understand the process. But one of the things that happened to me very early on is I wrote some story that a lot of the TV reporters were asking about at some press conference. I forgot what it was. No, it was about, I did a story about Obama saying his president's telling groups privately that his presidency was on the line. That representatives had to vote for the health care plan because his presidency was on the line and he'd be crippled.
Latino. He said that to a Latino group, right.
I got some anecdotes, and the White House did not really like that story. And like this procession of TV reporters, kind of cool because I had been relatively new to the process, and I didn't know how the briefing room worked, and I didn't know that the TV reporters went first. So a lot of the TV reporters asked that question, and I got two emails on my BlackBerry during the press conference from White House officials who were like, I hope you're happy with yourself. The story was BS, but, you know, you got everybody, you know. So you get that sort of, like, that kind of reaction sometimes.
Have you ever had, either at the White House or on the Hill, have you ever had a situation where there was a lot of pressure that's put on your bosses, and they tell you to dial it back for one reason or another?
I'm trying to think. No, not in this job. Uh-huh. I've had situations at other places that have been really awful. without naming my employer or the particular story, I had one story that I was publishing in the middle of an election that was had some fairly devastating details about a candidate. Devastating may be too strong a word, but pretty damaging. And I was told that the story couldn't run because it would have an impact on the campaign, which is just an unacceptable thing for an editor to say. And I nearly quit over that and had to negotiate to get the story in the paper. That was a horrific experience. I've also had been leaked memos that a career-ending memo for a member of Congress which I had good sourcing on, that again, another newspaper chose not to run because they thought, again, it would bring them too much trouble. So I've had situations in my career where, Politico has been, I mean, these guys, one of the reasons I'm working here is these guys are, you know, are real reporters.
Okay. Another question?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Yep. All right. I have a question that I've actually always wanted to get answered. Is the outlets in which you get your news information controlled by the government to a point, or is it taken from general stories that do not come from a particular place?
Oh, what do you mean? Could you just sort of clarify? What do you mean controlled by the government?
Like, is it filtered by a certain... A certain organization in the government before you guys actually release it? Or is it just whatever?
You mean like White House, the information comes from the White House?
Yeah, is it filtered? Is it just whatever comes from the White House? Is it whatever happens, or is it filtered by the White House or by the government?
My actual story?
Yes.
Oh, no. We've got this thing called the First Amendment. Yeah, no. That's there's a lot of things. There are a lot of things that I will complain about, but we do not have a censor's office.
Well, I think she was thinking though too of that you rely heavily on information that comes out of the White House.
Well, yeah. I mean,
what information that comes out of the White House is useful to you, and what kind of information do you get from elsewhere?
I think. A lot of information comes out of the White House, and most of it is background noise. I mean, the information that you get proactively from the White House tends to be the sort of stuff that they want you to write about, and that really typically is not the stuff that I want to write about. So I tend to sort of now there are certain things you have to do. That, you know, if there's an announcement or a policy change or an appointment. You know, clearly you write about that. But oftentimes you just get deluged with information that just isn't that important. So a key part of my job is sort of sifting through the stuff you get officially from the White House and a lot of stuff you get unofficially from the White House and trying to discern whether or not there's really news there and why it is that they're trying to give it to you. The why is incredibly important. And it also, you know, the reporters that I really respect are the reporters that ask that question of their sources. Why are you giving this to me?
Mm-hmm.
What does your giving it? And you also have to recognize that the transaction of you receiving information from somebody is part of the larger story. The White House is giving you something or telling you something because they want to achieve a specific political objective. And I think you're a fool. And you're responsible, and you're not practicing journalism correctly, if you don't factor that in.
But they're not going to tell you.
No.
Like for example, if somebody wants to, either you've got a policy debate going on, and somebody gives you a story about some of the actors in the policy debate, because they think that. If it gets the light of day, it will kill the policy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So you get that, but they're not going to say doing this because I want to see this.
But
stuff
you know,
killed.
I mean, but you know that that's the case. There's some piece of Oppo that I got recently. There was a piece that I put on my blog that I took a lot of criticism for. Now blog is different because a blog because the items are short, you're looking to achieve balance overall. So an individual item may be sort of an opposition research item that isn't particularly contexted, but what you want to do, you want to get comment on it, but what you want to do is balance that with other items. So with a blog is an interesting organism because the balance that you achieve is not within each individual blog post, but in the aggregate. So you want the whole thing to be fair, but each individual piece might not necessarily be completely contexted. So a blog post has to be seen in the larger context of how that blog is run and what other narratives that you're telling.
It does. Do you have different thresholds of measures for accuracy?
No, not for accuracy.
Uh-huh.
So but for context, I'm trying to remember the exact example on this because I took some heat on this. There's a guy named Rossi out in Washington State who is considering a run against the Democratic incumbent for Senate, Patty Murray out there. And somebody, some Democratic operative, and I identified the leak as from a Democratic operative, sent me a fundraising letter that this guy Rossi wrote for an organization that was associated with wanting to cut unemployment benefits in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty tough
sell for particularly for a Democrat.
Tough sell in an environment where you have regular state unemployment in excess of 9%. And I wrote the story, and I did all my due diligence, made 4 or 5 phone calls, got comment, pushback. But a lot of people thought, well, why? The guy's not a Senate candidate yet. He personally has not endorsed this policy. Why would you run this? And it was clearly given to you by a Democratic operative. And my reason for that is, by my doing the post, because the ideas espoused by this organization were so radical, including, by the way, of eliminating the family leave policy for the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy endorsed this organization. I felt it was incumbent upon Rossi or his people to disavow his association with this group. I would not have written that blog post if Rossi's people had called me up and said, he doesn't agree with that. He's against cutting unemployment. But I gave them, I believe, 6 hours to sort of comment on that. And I spoke to him a variety of people, or contacted a variety of people, and they chose not to disavow himself. And I felt that was clearly a one-sided item, but I gave them an opportunity to respond, and I thought that reached the threshold of fairness.
Uh-huh. Okay. Another question?
First of all, I like your hat.
Thank you.
Since
I'm bald.
Gotcha. Since Politico is an online publication, do you get treated less seriously, like at the White House, or is it more difficult to get to talk with White House officials than you would, if you worked for the New York Times or CNN?
Well, the short answer to that is no, because Politico is so, we're in a funny situation, because they do nothing but complain about us and then read us constantly. It's funny, when you walk into the White House press office, you walk in there and you see our websites on their screen all the time. So, and God forbid you should get, you don't dot an I across a T, they're on you like that. So, and it's for junkies, and the people who populate the White House are political junkies. So Politico is a really unique creature. And also the kind of people, apart from myself, who we've hired are pretty heavy hitters and have had careers and people, we sort of bring our own gravitas with us. Nobody in this White House gets the kind of attention or carries the kind of weight that the Times does. I think the Times, the David Sanger fight notwithstanding, the Times, they read the Times, they respect the Times. I think the Times carries tremendous weight. The networks are a different matter, and I think actually the respect that the White House has for the networks is not great. It's a really funny paradox with the White House, because they complain about the networks, and Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, gave an interview with Howie Kurtz over the weekend, the Washington Post media writer, in which he sort of accused network folks of preening, I think that was the word, right, at press conferences, and or posing or something like that. But the White House pays enormous attention to them and calls on them all the time. So there's this really symbiotic relationship. But no, Politico doesn't... I think we have a reputation as being kind of like cowboys, I think is the way people have referred to us in the White House, that we're kind of, that we write process stories, that we, you know, that we take sharper angles on things than the other daily papers do. So I think they pay a lot of attention to us, and they complain about us a lot, but we get our phone calls returned. Did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Another question?
I had been reading one of your articles on the website, and it was the one about the Wall Street bill. And what exactly is your prediction as to what Mitch McConnell said with not allowing a single GOP vote to go towards the new Wall Street bill?
It's not going to happen. They're going to get for those of you that are uninitiated, there's the big battle now is the financial regulatory reform on Wall Street. The Republicans have 41 Republicans. I'm sure I'll be nice. There's a filibuster in the Senate. In order to get even a bill discussed or voted on, you have to have 60 senators agree to vote on it. The election of Scott Brown in Massachusetts in January robbed the Democrats of their 60-vote majority. So now the Republicans at least control what's on the floor. Very big deal. There's 41 Republican senators signed a letter saying that they wanted to see significant changes in this Wall Street bill. And that they're going to hold the line. But I'm telling you right now, there's a lot of anger against Wall Street out there in the country, and Republicans, probably not Mitch McConnell, are going to be forced to vote for this thing. Democrats are going to make some changes, but I don't think the Republicans are stupid enough to block this thing. People really, really, really hate Wall Street right now. And a story that I'm writing for tomorrow has to do with Chuck Schumer, the New York Democratic senator, who really got a lot of money from Wall Street and helped the Democrats get their majority by getting money from bank executives and hedge fund managers, and he has turned completely against Wall Street, even though he's taking a lot of criticism about it back home. So my prediction is you're going to have, at the end of the day, 2 to 6 Republican senators siding with the Democrats on this. But, you know, things, it's been a crazy year, man, and, you know, crazier things have happened than the thing getting blocked.
Have you found a difference from, well, you haven't been at the White House that long, but in watching it, how their communications works from the beginning of their administration to now?
Well,
what differences do you see?
Good question. I mean, my time frame is actually different because I do know, what I should say is I covered the campaign for Newsday, and I covered the Clinton campaign. So I was in constant contact with most of the vast majority of the guys in the press office, men and women in the press office, I know, from dealing with them on the campaign. So I know how they dealt with reporters during the campaign.
Yeah.
Things are tight right now. Things are very tight.
Mm-hmm.
People are, I think, folks feel more comfortable and looser and a little more relaxed in their interactions because they passed the health care reform bill. But I'm just surprised by the antipathy that they have towards the press in general.
Do you think that comes from their having been campaign people? That in a campaign, you've got one goal, which is to win the election. And you have to win each day.
Yep.
And so you've got your guy's the good guy, the other guy's the bad guy. And so when you come into the White House, you know, you're not running against anybody, but there's still a bad guy.
That's
and the bad guy's the press.
You're hitting the nail on the head. And, you know, again, my experience at the White House is not that great, and you've had experience with a ton of administration, so you've seen this stuff close up. But I've had two recent encounters that reinforce that point beautifully. I had a conversation with one White House official who shall remain very much nameless, who said to me, part of the reason we got killed on the healthcare stuff was because we didn't have an enemy. And this is a group of people that focuses best, I'm talking about Obama's press staff, on a single focal enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you notice, they're talking a lot more about Mitch McConnell, the minority leader in the Senate. I think that's less because I don't think most Americans know who Mitch McConnell is, but I think it focuses their energy on a common enemy. Hillary was the demon. Having been a Hillary reporter, the sense that they have about Hillary being the enemy really, really really focus them. And the other thing about it is, the other thing that's been sort of stunning to me, despite my love of campaigns, I like policy. And I'm interested in policy. I don't get to write about it very much. But I've been really struck by the, I wouldn't say contempt, but sort of a lack of interest in policy and governing in general that there is among executive department press people. They love campaigns. They think of everything. They can't wait for the next one to come around. They're not that interested. I actually approached one flack in the administration and sort of said, I've been really impressed by the depth of your knowledge on the issue that you cover. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really impressive when you can talk to a press person and they know things in really great depth. And they're like, oh, I hate it. I wish I was back on the campaign.
Uh-huh.
So I think your observation is absolutely.
Yeah. Well, now in a lot of press offices, they actually bring in people who have not necessarily been campaigning people, on that campaign. Like, for example, Marlon Fitzwater. Marlon Fitzwater, I think his success came from understanding how you talk about policy,
right. How
difficult it is to get information, and all the strategies you need as a press office person,
right.
And as a press secretary, and as a deputy before that, because he had worked, his career was in executive branch departments as a public information officer. And I think McCurry was successful in the same way because he had been at the State Department before,
right.
Even though he'd done a lot of campaigns. His previous experience was the State Department. And the State Department's particularly good because you learn the resonance of language and you're working with policy.
Right.
And that one of the things here is that it's all campaign people.
Right.
There's nobody there that's not a campaign person.
My sense is that that will probably change over time. But yeah, I think it really lends a sense of sort of combativeness to it and arrestiveness to the operation. I think these guys are really like, I think Obama's headed back out on the road. He's going to be doing a lot of events, pushing the Wall Street stuff. And I think the whole crew just feels better when they're in motion.
In the Bush administration, one of the things they did in preparation right before the 2002 congressional elections was to have a focus that would get their base pulled together and, in a sense, reinvent and rekindle the enthusiasm that they had had. And what they used was the court.
Right.
And it was federal court positions and how they had been held up in the Senate, although they really hadn't been any more held up than it happened to Democrats. But that became a way to rally people. And then right before the election, they had several events that focused on the court. And you would think in the court system, do that many people care?
Right.
But their base cared, and it was a political issue that they use to ignite them.
That's a huge issue now with the Obama folks. I mean, you see they call it the enthusiasm gap, and you really see it. And I think the big problem, and this is something Obama's really grappling with, is how do you compromise? You have to make compromises to get these big items passed. Healthcare reform, you had to drop the public option. Well, that's fine. So you've accomplished this stuff. But in the process, you've made your base cynical. And Obama's brand was hope and change, and those are future. Those are sort of, those are pointing towards the future. How do you get them to focus and be energized in the present? And I think it's a huge problem for them.
One of the things that I did when shortly after they came in and created a website that they would distribute information to you,
right?
And so I signed up for that because I wanted to see what they put out, and I also signed up on an account that I knew that everything that I was getting from Obama was coming from having signed up, and it was signing up at the White House, and I get a lot of political stuff, and I found generally that it. It's not something, the messages are not something that would stir me into action.
Right.
Have you read the stuff that they send out?
Oh, yeah.
Organizing for America or the or some of the other stuff that they have?
They don't have great. First of all, in defense of them, it's much harder to sort of defend an existing, a sitting president than attack one.
Oh yeah.
And it just so it's sort of like they start off in a defensive posture, but this was the Karl Rove's genius. Rove energized. Had that religious right-wing right. base that was extraordinarily uh-huh. interested in abortion rights and stem cells,
and gay marriage. They used that in 2004.
Right. So I don't think the Democrats have a comparable base. The problem with the Democrats is they have a really polyglot base. So if in Obama, I think the crucial example right now. Is Obama last night did a fundraiser in L.A. for, I think it was L.A., for Barbara Boxer, that was interrupted by gay marriage advocates mm-hmm. who are unsatisfied with his don't ask, don't tell policy. And he is constrained about how far he can go, because if he comes out completely in favor of gay marriage, and I am told that he probably personally supports that position, he will alienate a lot of folks that the Democrats picked up in the Midwest and Upper South. Mm-hmm. The Democrats don't really have, and I know like a couple of, in talking to some strategists back in 2008 and 2006 in Democratic Senate races, the issues, and no one really talks about this, the issues that really fired up the base were stem cells, the irrationality that Democrats believed uh-huh. of the Bush administration limiting stem cells, and law enforcement issues, like good old-fashioned law enforcement issues, but with women prosecutors. So you saw this wave in 2006 and 2008 of Amy Klobuchar and Claire McCaskill, of sort of tough female prosecutors, were sort of a huge winning. So there are things that you don't necessarily see on the news that really motivate the base. And I think what they're trying right now to do is figure out what those issues are.
Uh-huh, yeah. And the Bush White House definitely had those down and used them
brilliantly
in their the congressional yeah. campaigns. Another question?
Have I exhausted you? I see a hand. Is that a hand?
Yeah, good.
Hey. Hi. Do you find that your most influential stories were achieved through regular journalistic research, by luck, or by who you know?
Well, that's a good question. I think regular journalistic research is good luck in who you know. I think those things are. I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any such thing as regular journalistic research. I think what you do is you put yourself. It's like any other thing. You put yourself in a position where you can succeed. The main thing that you have to do as a reporter is the care and feeding of your sources. Is developing relationships with people, identifying those relationships that are important in terms of doing your job, and then cultivating them. And so it's not, you don't view each story necessarily as a one-time event, but in the continuum of these relationships. Very early on, I was dealing with a spokesperson for a city agency back in New York, who was just being nice to me for no reason at all. I was working for a not very influential publication. And I said, why are you being nice to me? And this person said, because I see you're going to go places. And I want you to remember me when you go where you're going. And you're going to be important to me later on. And sure enough, that turned out to be true. So I think regular journalistic, the notion that we just, and a lot of reporting is like going through campaign finance filings or looking at property records. I mean, that's really the good stuff, or going door to door. But a lot of what we do, particularly as political reporters, are develop these relationships and just constantly. I mean, part of what I do every single day is I sit down, I have a little red book that's in my back pocket right now, and I write the names of 20 people I'm going to call, regardless mm-hmm. of what story it is that I'm doing. And I used to actually have a screensaver when I was freelancing, that was like, if you haven't called 20 people today, you're not doing your job. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are basically as good as the information that we receive. And a lot of reporters in this age just check their email boxes all the time, reflexively, or check Twitter. I find the phone or personal interactions are the way to do it. So to me, the regular process of reporting are those relationships. And I think luck is the residue of that design. Like if you are, the other thing is to write a lot of stories, is to be productive. People to see your name, it sounds stupid, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Have your name out there, be writing a lot of stuff, and you start just getting people, the luck part of it comes in and people see your name. So, oh, I read this guy's stuff all the time. I see, you know, I'm going to give him a call with a call about this story. I think a lot of reporters in this town, and this is something I'm sort of less adept at, use TV that way. They get, you know, to me, TV's a pain in the neck. The first couple of times you do it, you get calls from your aunt in California, and it's kind of cool when you're on MSNBC. But to me, it's like an hour out of my day. I can't call people. I can't, you know, I can't see my kids. In Washington in particular, it's a really important leveraging tool. People like Chris Saliza of the Washington Post are really adept, and some other reporters at Politico like Jonathan Martin are just really adept at kind of leveraging their performances on TV, their appearances on TV, into having people identify them as someone that they want to go to. So I think sort of the luck part of it is about being in the right place at the right time and having people identify you as somebody they want to send information to.
I know somebody had said, had talked about your reporting and said he really works the phones well. So when you're working the phones and calling those 20 people, are you asking for information? Are you telling them something? Are you just catching up with them?
All of the above. I like, you know, I like to have conversations with people. And I find like, and I enjoy, look, you know, you got to do what you enjoy. And I enjoy talking with people. I mean, the cool part about our jobs is we get to talk to really smart, really engaged, really interested people. I mean, we don't work, you know, I don't work in a salt mine, you know. I have a great job. And like, the people that I tend to bond with as sources are people I like as people. You know what I mean?
Right.
We have a commonality of interest. So I think it is very important to sort of prime the pump by giving people information. I've always been about that, but that just tends to come out of me in general. I'm not a very, I have to say, I'm not disciplined and strategic in the conversations I have with people. I just tend to want to talk about stuff. And I find, now that makes writing kind of tough sometimes because you've had all these unstructured conversations and you look at your notebook, and I have terrible handwriting, try to decipher what it was that I got out of these conversations because I was talking and they were talking. The one thing I think is important with those interactions is that you give people an opportunity to express themselves. There's a reporter that I know who I've seen work, and I've had several of these experiences, who will answer the questions before. He will pose a question to a source and then answer that question before giving that source an opportunity to talk. So it's a fine line, but I think... you know, when I work the phones, I'm having conversations with people. I'm challenging them. You know, the point is, you know, I had someone describe it to me once as a safe space. So you get to sort of have these, you can yell, you know, part of my job, another thing that I've noticed is, and I've said this before, is the people I have the best and most lasting relationships with are the people that I start out fighting with. Because you then... learning how someone fights and comes back at you and how you fight with them is basically defining the relationship. Are you respectful? Are you listening to them? Are you willing to stand up for what you believe? Are they willing to contest a fact? Are they fighting dirty? Are they getting personal? If you have these probing conversations with people and you determine that they're tough, they disagree with you, but they keep it within a certain boundary, they respect you, you respect them, that's a person you can really do business with. So I don't know if other reporters do this, but, I mean, I dig the interaction, and that's part of what I... I don't know if it's great reporting, but it's, like, what I enjoy doing.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it. We've hit our time.
Great.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.